Yes Live Show. I'm your host for the show, Robin Daly, and in 2005 I founded the UK charity Yes to Life to help people with cancer to access integrative medicine techniques. 12 years later, we're still doing just that, although we're helping many more people than ever. A sign not only of the ever-increasing need, of course, but also of the growing awareness of the wider view of what cancer is and how we should therefore treat it. As ever, my guest for the show this week reflects the fast-developing science of integrative medicine, this week looking at the increasingly popular ketogenic diet. This month, US nutrition expert Miriam Kalamian has a new book released, Keto for Cancer. I've managed to talk to her in the US to find out more about the book just ahead of its publication. Hi Miriam, thanks very much for coming on the Yes to Life show today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Great. So we're going to talk about your new book, Keto for Cancer. And if there's one thing that really polarizes views, it's diets for cancer. There's no shortage of choice out there. Gerson set the ball rolling nearly a century ago. And at this point, you can often find that two diets based on theories that actually contradict each other can both be helpful to some people. Then, of course, there's plenty of people who say that diet's got nothing to do with recovery from cancer at all. That's probably the biggest polarity of all.
Oh, yes.
It's a confusing picture, to be sure. So what makes you feel that ketogenics has something concrete to offer those with cancer?
Well, it started with my own personal experience with it. My son was diagnosed with brain cancer in 2004, and by 2007, we'd kind of run out of all the available options. I accidentally came on the diet. We figured, what have we got to lose? We put him on the diet, and he had a stunning response to it. So when you see something like that, it's a life-changing event. To see that something as simple as a change in the mix of the foods that he ate could have such a profound impact on his tumor metabolism. Nothing else had done that.
Personal experience. Yeah, you can't beat it. Yeah, so I would like to ask you about that, actually, about your personal experience to start us off. I mean, obviously your book's for a wide audience, but it's a very personal story for you in this way. Would you mind saying exactly how this has played into your own work?
Oh, definitely. So in 2007, like I said, I accidentally found the diet. They were going to move. They were planning on moving my son to a palliative treatment, which would have meant hospitalizations and transfusions and infections and just a really poor quality of life. And they weren't even projecting, you know, much of a life. And so, like I said, I felt like we didn't have anything to lose by trying this. And in just 3 months, we saw a response. So we continued with it pretty strongly for 3 years. But when I saw that response, Robin, and I was so alone in the keto world back then. This was in 2007, the spring of 2007. And yes, Thomas Seyfried had just had that. That's what I found, was his mouse model of glioma, which is a type of brain cancer, and how a ketogenic diet had improved the survival, didn't cure them, improved their survival. And he related it back to a case of Linda Nabling had done in the 1990s. She had implemented a ketogenic diet with two pediatric brain tumor patients, and with, again, you know, a difference in the tumor metabolism seen in both of those young patients. So here it was something that was, you know, tried in a pediatric population. And as a treatment for epilepsy, it was actually evidence-based and accepted as a treatment for epilepsy in the pediatric population. My son was 7 years old. I was not ready to give up on him. And I had to know everything that I could. I had to learn everything that I could. And the only way to do that in a non-keto world where you're being told eat a balanced diet is to go back to school. And I did that. I immediately entered a program, Masters of Nutrition, and Masters in Human Nutrition, and a very solid program at Eastern Michigan, one that registered dietitians go through. And so I got that training. But as I went through that program, I was always looking at how does this work for ketogenic? How does this work for ketogenic? And I didn't pursue the RD after graduation because I just wanted to get right into my work. So in 2010, I started working with people with cancer. And I had a lot to share, a lot of personal experience, and that's a big part of my book. That's what I was able to do, was weave the advocacy and my son's story in with the very practical recommendations on how to implement this and how to monitor it.
So was this a massive change of direction for you, this training?
Oh, my God, yeah. I had a degree, a master's degree in education, and I taught, years ago. But in the interim, I had gotten involved in something very traditional to Armenian families. And so I was trading in Oriental rugs. And that's what I was doing here in Montana when my son was diagnosed. And then, even up through the time that I was going through my grad program. This was a major change, but it's driven by passion. And when you have a child that is just slipping away from you the way that my son was slipping away, man, you will do anything. And I will do anything to help people, help families that are in a similar situation. Right. And it's not just children I work with, and it's not just brain cancer. I work with across a range of cancers. And from everything from, children to the elderly.
Okay, thank you. So the ketogenic diet hasn't gained any traction in UK oncology, but it is beginning to make some ground in the public consciousness amongst those with cancer. For the benefit of the listeners who don't know anything about it yet, though, could you give us kind of the basics, the basic principles that are behind the ketogenic diet?
Okay. It might be simpler to start with something like the Atkins diet. I would think that just about everybody knows what the Atkins diet is. Low carbohydrate and a weight loss, basically a weight loss program, kind of expanded into more of a program now that can address metabolic issues as well as weight. But the tweak to it as a ketogenic diet, coming from the epilepsy world, ketogenic diet is very low in carbohydrates, limited in the amount of protein. So that, Atkins, unlimited protein, ketogenic, limited protein. And in Atkins, they don't pay much attention to fat because it's like, okay, good quality fat, but there's no pressure to eat fat. And I would say there's no pressure in a ketogenic diet as well, but we put a lot more emphasis on replacing the carbohydrates, the calories that are lost through carbohydrate, with fat. Now, when I'm working with somebody who is overweight, carrying some excess weight, I will calorie restrict that program. Don't touch. It's the same amount of carbohydrate as a more rigorous ketogenic plan, and it's the same amount of protein as a rigorous ketogenic plan. But what we adjust is the amount of fat, kind of the target amount of fat intake for the day.
Okay, so that gives us an idea of what it looks like. So I want to sort of move into your book now. So this is quite a handbook, basically. There's a lot in here. And
there's a lot, yeah.
I haven't read it cover to cover, but I've certainly looked through it cover to cover, so I know what's in there. So the diet itself is a direct affront to many key pieces of scientific dogma, the most notable, of course, being the genetic theory of the origins of cancer. You meet this one head on right at the outset of your book. Could you summarize, why are you dissenting from the mainstream view?
Actually, the reason to dissent from the mainstream view is not because I want to trash it or that I want people to, I see this diet as an adjunct. This is not a standalone standalone protocol for treatment of cancer. I see it as an adjunct. And I think as long as the traditional oncology world sees it as a threat, we're never going to be able to work together. But I see a change in that. And even though, like you said, it's not accepted in the oncology world as a treatment, I see much less resistance to it now. Instead of doctors discouraging people from doing it, they'll say things like diet doesn't matter, which I see as a green light. Go ahead and do the ketogenic diet. So no, seriously, I don't see that as an obstacle at all. So the genetic theory, boy, it's seductive, isn't it? That you could have, that you could identify a genetic mutation and then go after it with a drug. But in reality, that is not happening. The drugs that are targeted to the genetics are not treating the underlying cause. And the underlying cause is a change in the metabolism of a cancer cell. So a healthy cell is going to take glucose, it converts it to something called pyruvate, and then it's going to oxidize it in the mitochondria of the cell. It's a very efficient process. Cancer cells don't do this. They convert to pyruvate, and then the bulk of that pyruvate stays in the cytoplasm of the cell, and it gets fermented. Extremely inefficient process, creates a lot of lactic acid, which is a waste product, shunted to the outside into the microenvironment of a tumor cell. That causes inflammation that allows the tumor cell to, encourages proliferation and disease progression. So it's a really negative cascade, that change in tumor cell metabolism. Mm-hmm. And that was observed back in the 1920s. Otto Warburg, he saw that in the 1920s, and that's never been in dispute, that cancer cells robustly ferment glucose. That's never been disputed by anybody. But in the 1950s, along comes this model of DNA unveiled by Watson and Crick. And then in the 70s, the discovery of these DNA genetic mutations, and I believe wrongly so, those two things have been linked ever since to create this genetic or somatic view that cancer is just a genetic disease. But you can't separate genetics from metabolism. You can't do that. It's unreasonable to think on anybody's part, if the researchers really stop to think about this, you can't separate those two things.
Mm. So this is a kind of chicken and egg argument, this one. This is which of these two things is a side effect or a symptom, if you like, and which is an underlying cause? That seems to be the nub of the argument.
Right, and that debate can continue. They can argue about that till, the cows come home. But my feeling is that, educate and inform people about this diet and make it an option, make it a choice. Because what I see is that it affects cancer cell metabolism through the epigenetic changes. Those are the changes influenced by the food that we eat, the toxins in our environment. And they're there. I mean, it's obvious that our environment is pretty toxic. And those things all influence gene expression in cells, either for better or for worse. Mm-hmm. So why not do the things that are going to inhibit cancer progression and support the pathways that are associated with good health? There can't be a downside to that. I believe we really need research to identify which cancers and even which subtypes, which mutations are going to respond best to a ketogenic diet and which ones this might not be a great option for. Mm-hmm. And there are people that this is not appropriate for. And that's one of the things I make clear in my book, that there are, contraindications to the diet. There are conditions that mean you either need some extra supervision and monitoring when you're doing this, and by extra I mean above and beyond what the norm would be in cancer, especially if you have a comorbidity that affects, or a health condition I should call it, that affects the liver or the pancreas, you could think type 1 diabetes or certain types of cancers of the liver are going to affect how you can approach this diet.
Yeah. So you mentioned epigenetics along the way there as being the study of the things that actually influence our genes from outside. That's kind of the missing link, if you like, in between the two worlds, isn't it, of the metabolic
yes.
and the genes. This is what's joining them together, and making one influence the uh-huh. other.
Yeah, absolutely. That if cancer researchers who are firmly tied to the genetic theory were to actually get involved in the epigenetic influences and to look at some of what are called the cybrid theories. I know one of them in my book. And that is, okay, when you look at cancer cells, what's happening in the cytoplasm of the cell, which is not, not the DNA of the nucleus, what's happening in the cytoplasm of the cell is so much more predictive of cancer progression than what's happening in the nucleus with the genes. It's the expression of the genes that's most important. And one of the things that a ketogenic diet does is it inhibits something called HDAC, histone deacetylase. So it inhibits the unwelcome unraveling of the DNA that invites genetic damage. It inhibits that activity. And, along with, like I said before, suppressing the pathways that are associated with cancer progression, and I'll just throw out a couple of them, called mTOR and IGF-1, and upregulating the pathways associated with health. And let me stress, you do not need to know the science you in order to implement this diet. But I want people to be aware of the science, because that's what I'm about, is educating and informing and advocating. You can't advocate for yourself if all you can say about the diet is that you heard it's going to starve your cancer of glucose, because that is just way too simplistic, and no wonder it turns off cancer oncologists and researchers when they hear that. There's so much more. That epigenetic part of it is so important.
Right. Okay, so be well informed.
Yes.
So, in the book, you give over the first good 100 pages or so to the history and the thinking behind the ketogenic approach, as well as to considerations of whether it's a good choice, particularly for you. And you devote a chapter to the evidence out there to back up the diet. So at this point, would you just give us your general assessment of the level of evidence we have and how you feel this should inform patients who are interested in this approach?
Well, the level of evidence is, I discard anything that's done in vitro. In other words, that's just done in a cancer cell line study, because that's not how cancer cells behave in the body. So I don't consider that as part of the evidence that I want to move forward with. But if you look at the animal models, particularly the mouse models, that have been developed to test, and then you look at the types of the results and the conclusions that can be drawn to the mouse model from those results. So from there, of course, we have to move to clinical trials in order for this to be part of the oncology language, and that's a tougher thing to do for a couple of reasons. First, you need support from within the oncology community to do this. And there are some very passionate researchers at individual institutions, usually smaller, state universities. And it's really hard to recruit numbers within that group that are going to impress anybody as evidence-based. That's a huge problem in clinical trials. When you look at how clinical trials, they're traditionally, they cost millions, if not sometimes billions of dollars. They're conducted by pharmaceutical companies. The products that come out of that, the drugs that come out of that, are extremely high cost. And the level of evidence needed for those studies, and something, just to give you an example, in brain cancer, which is highly aggressive, very poor prognosis for glioblastoma multiforme, one of the most aggressive forms. So drugs that get approved, the drug Temodar, that got approved, all it had to show was that in people with a certain a genetic mutation, a methylation status called MGMT, that all it had to do was provide a couple of extra months. And I really mean that, just like two and a half months of added life. Doesn't say anything about quality of life, just added life in order for that drug to get approved. And now that drug is the standard of care for everybody, whether or not it's going to work for them or not. There's no evidence it's going to work for somebody without that methylation status. So, but they go ahead and they do it anyway, standard of care, and they're using it even on some low-grade tumors, which, you know, I think because of its potential to change a brain tumor, from having 50 or 60 mutations to having 1,000 mutations, it's like, what are we doing? How, you know, why are we doing this? Is there evidence to support this in the oncology world? And the answer is no. So, you know, it's a mixed message from people who are the traditional oncology that puts all their eggs in that evidence-based basket. They're willing to set the evidence coming out of a clinical trial that shows just a couple of months of benefit. Okay, we're going to do this now. But they're not willing to rethink. They're just not flexible enough in their thinking to say, okay, there's some people this is not appropriate for. So as far as the evidence, I've worked with over 500 people. I don't mean that, you know, I don't follow them from, you know, moment to, you know, for years at a time, although people who are doing well tend to get back to me and tell me how well they're doing. So, you know, people with, I have a woman with, that I keep in contact with glioblastoma multiforme, GBM. She's 6 years out. Another woman is 4 years out. Another man that I worked with is close to 4 years out. You don't often see these numbers, this kind of survival. The general timeline is about 14 to 16 months if everything is working in your favor.
And it's important to differentiate the very real dangers, such as you outlined, of a drug-based approach, and to set them against the risks involved in doing a diet.
The diet is virtually, I don't see a risk in doing the diet for most people except for the contraindications I laid out. And like I said, I stress that it needs to be an adjunct therapy. You cannot do ketogenic. I don't support ketogenic as a standalone therapy. I think if people want to do it, and there are some people in the UK that are doing it as standalone, that is absolutely their decision, just as much as it's their decision whether they should go along with their, you know, with every protocol that's presented to them. People have to make choices and advocate for themselves, and they may make a wrong choice, and they need to live with that in, you know, with a diet, as much as they need to live with that in the conventional oncology world. People make mistakes all the time in conventional oncology. They're just, you know, for some reason, it's more acceptable in that world than it is if somebody were to make a mistake with the diet. And I just don't see, I don't think you can have a stage four cancer and be, you know, in hospice and expect that this is going to turn your life around. I just don't see a downside for people using it as an adjunct therapy from day one of your diagnosis.
So the worst thing that can happen is nothing, which begs the question, well, why is the level of evidence that's required in anything like the same league as for potentially dangerous drugs?
That's an excellent question. And I do want to say, we don't have the research to know if there are cancers that this may not be a good idea for. There may be cancers that can upregulate what we call the glycolytic enzymes that are can utilize ketones. But in most of the cancer models that we look at, what happens is those enzymes are just not as available in the mitochondria. And so the mitochondria are not able to use ketones for energy. They have to rely on other activities going on in the mitochondria and on the cytoplasm. And that's what we're trying to impact with diet. So the diet may not be a good idea for a few cancers, But we can't separate those out. There's without research, we can't know which ones it's not going to be helpful for. But we know that the drugs out there are much, at least my opinion, is that the drugs out there are much less predictable in their response with or without this genetic component to it. They're getting a little more information with targeted therapies, but it's so complex. People don't have just one mutation. So if you're targeting one mutation without looking at epigenetically changing everything that's going on in that cell, what's the result of that going to be? You're going to go along for a while, and then the cancer cells that know how to evade the effect of the drug are going to be the predominant one. And then what do? You go after them with another drug. And each one of those drugs has significant quality of life impacts on that person, and they just get worn down over time. You get worn down, and you don't get worn down by the diet. If it's done properly, it has to be well formulated.
Right. Okay, well, that's important. So you would obviously advocate expert supervision for that?
Yes, education and monitoring. You need to have somebody to check in with about what you're doing. And there are exceptions to that. There's some people that, when they first contact me, they've got it, as Jeff Bullock would say, they've got it dialed in. So they may have some questions still, and they may need some additional resources, but they understand what the goal is. And the goal is not to cure cancer here. The goal is to manage it in a way that maintains quality of life. And that's what we got with our son. We had 6 years where he didn't have to show up every week at an oncology clinic or go to hospitals for transfusions. He didn't have to be on antibiotics. It was an amazing quality of life for most of that time.
That's extraordinary. Yeah, 6 years.
Yeah, yes. 6 extra years on, what the standard of care had already done.
Yeah, amazing. All right, well, in your book, you use the hybrid car analogy to explain the change you're trying to bring about by using the ketogenic diet. Could you just explain this now?
Yeah, okay. So in the world that we live in, with constant access to food, at least in the developed nations, we don't have much concern. Our diets have become predominantly carbohydrate. And by predominantly, I mean that, the guidelines for a so-called balanced diet say to eat 45 to 65% of your daily calories in the form of carbohydrates. And there is no dietary requirement for carbohydrate in a human diet. And that's something that people don't often understand. There's absolutely no requirement. There's requirements for amino acids. There's requirements for certain fats. But there is absolutely nothing in carbohydrate that's required as far as dietary intake. We can make all of the glucose we need in the liver, and it's an adaptation that ensured our survival when we missed meals back in the day. And we also, turn some of the products of fat oxidation, accessing those fat stores, we turn some of that product into the exact same fuel that glucose provides, or even that amino acids provide, but in a form of something called ketone bodies. And those ketone bodies in circulation can actually reach the brain. Fatty acids don't do a good job in the brain. And they can supply up to 60, some people say 70% of the brain's energy needs. It's another thing that people don't often understand. And even in my graduate level training, I still had to answer a question on quizzes. And sometimes it'd be, as part of an exam question. It would be a true or false question about the need for glucose by the brain and central nervous system. And I'd have to say, oh, yeah, it's essential just to satisfy the course requirements. But it's not essential to the functioning. It doesn't have to be the primary fuel. If ketones are meeting 60 to 70% of the energy needs, then that is not glucose is not a primary fuel. And everybody in nutrition understands that. but they still advocate for this balanced diet, because if you take out the carbohydrate, you have to increase one of the other two, fat or protein. Protein you can only go so far with, and then the balance would have to be fat, and then it would put you over the recommendation for fat, which is, in my opinion, way too low, and the top people in the fields are starting to recognize this. It hasn't filtered down into practice yet, but the top researchers understand that we don't need to restrict fat to less than 35%, and even that we don't need to restrict our intake of saturated fat.
Okay, yeah, it's a very different picture to the orthodox one. And it's another of the ways in which kind of your book and the whole ketogenic theory questions the dogma.
You bet. As a matter of fact, it's like conventional wisdom is not always wise, is a point I like to make with people. Right. Just because it's accepted doesn't mean it's good science. It doesn't even mean that it's evidence-based. So, that's another thing a lot of people don't understand. If you hear something over and over and over and over and over again, even if it's, you know, what here in the States gets called fake news, it becomes part of your thinking, even though, you know, a lot of it really is not proven. There's no evidence base to it. Never has been.
Right. Okay, well, talking about evidence and science, you devoted a chapter to science. You mentioned this earlier, that actually you'd like people to take on board the science. But you also said that you don't have to know the science in order to obviously benefit from the ketogenic diet. So it has to be said that some people have more of a bent for that kind of thing than others, and other people just go fuzzy the minute they see something a little bit complex or some new words they didn't know before. So literally, it's not what you'd like, but if people skip straight over the scientific stuff in your book, it's still going to be a great resource for them.
Of course. And I make that point, you know, that you can skip over the science because I work with people with very high stress. They're overwhelmed by this diagnosis, particularly if it has a very poor prognosis. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they don't have much support from family members. Other times they do. But the priority is to get up and running with the diet. You don't need to understand the science. So if this is doing its job and it's working and you can start to relax a little and go back and look at little bits and pieces and incorporate these things that are in there, sort of these ahas, incorporate them into your framework of thinking about the diet, you can make small steps over time and develop an understanding gradually. You don't need to know it all right up front in order for this to be effective. As long as you're implementing it correctly with a well-formulated diet, that's the most important thing from day one. Right. Learning the science is important so that you can intelligently address the concerns first of your family and friends, because they're so important to your support, to address their concerns about what you're doing, and then to address the concerns of the medical community. So what I see happening, even in people whose teams have been pretty resistant to them making a change in diet, is after they experience what, quote unquote, an amazing response to treatment, The medical team may then say, just keep doing what you're doing. They won't acknowledge that the diet played a role in it at all, because they can't. There's no way to prove that the diet is the thing that made the difference. But just to have them say, keep doing what it is that you're doing, is a tacit approval. And, you know, I'll take that for now. While we're working on the science, I'll take that, because people with cancer don't have the luxury of time to wait around for evidence that will please their oncology team. They need to do something right now.
Well, that's an extremely important point. And, of course, it is the thing that, really differentiates the position of someone with cancer to someone working with cancer. They don't have that luxury, and therefore a pragmatic right. choice for something that's very low risk and has some potential to help is, it makes complete sense.
I'm glad you feel that way. And I wish that more people, especially the detractors of the diet, would take a closer look before they make these, before they express opinions. What people come to me with a lot is their doctor's opinion. And I try to help them separate, beliefs and opinions from facts and science. And again, that's part of the advocacy. You have to advocate for yourself. But you also have to listen, you have to have that inner voice that's telling you that what you're doing is the right thing for you. If your inner voice is talking trash and telling you, well, what if this doesn't work, and and all the kinds of negative things that you can say to yourself, then, that's the time to really rethink what you're doing. You need to make a commitment to this. You need to be accountable for this and give it a try. It's not worth having a foot in both worlds, I call it, with trying to stay in the conventional world at the same time as making some changes that are mildly in the direction, like maybe if you just cut out grains and sugar. That's just not going to cut it. Right. If carbohydrates are still the majority of your diet, you're not going to be able to make that shift to burning fat, that hybrid fuel, that hybrid car that you mentioned earlier, is going to stay stuck burning gasoline, and it's not going to, it's not going to use any alternative energy at all. It's not going to use the electricity that's there. It's just going to keep burning gas.
Right. So as with most things, if you're going to gain any advantage, you've got to be very committed to it, and you've got to really go for it, basically.
Yeah, and I say give it a trial. And if in 2 months you're not feeling better and you're not seeing any response to the diet, then, if you've done it correctly and it was well formulated to start with and it's not helping you within 2 months, then why continue with it? Just go back to whatever feels right to you.
Well, that's good to know. I mean, that's that time frame is very useful, because, of course, the sort of flogging a dead horse analogy comes in, and going on with something that's clearly not working for you, not good from the point of view of wasted time and energy, but also psychologically, of course, hanging on to something that's not working.
Right, psychologically. Yeah. If it's not helping in 2 months, if you don't see an impact on a scan in 2 months, then you may not see an impact at 4 months or 6 months. But generally, the more aggressive the cancer, the more often I'll hear that somebody has had an amazing response to treatment. It's harder to tell what's going on if you have something like early stage, newly diagnosed breast cancer. You really can't make an evaluation of whether the diet is helping your cancer. So what you look for then is it helping my overall health? Do I feel better now than I did before I started the diet? Am I less brain fog? Am I getting through this chemo treatment better? I heard from a woman who, the daughter of a woman with cancer, who had started the chemotherapy. She went through her first round of chemotherapy, and it was a disaster. She was just bedridden for days afterwards, felt terrible. So in the meantime, between the first and the second round, she got up to speed with the diet and also employed what's known as short-term fasting around chemotherapy. So she stopped eating, X amount of hours before she went in for her chemo infusion, and then she didn't eat again until at least the following day. And she sailed through that. She was out taking a walk with her daughter the next day instead of lying in bed. So we know that these strategies can improve quality of life for people who are undergoing cancer treatment. And that, that's important to me. Maintaining good nutrition, quality of life, feeling more energetic, having a clearer mind, hopefully more resistant to the effects of chemotherapy on the brain. We know that, chemo brain is a real thing. And we're hoping that the anti-inflammatory effect of ketones on neurons is going to preserve more brain cells, make them less susceptible to damage by chemotherapy. Healthy brain cells, not protect the damaged ones.
Well, that's great information. I mean, you know, 2 month commitment is, yeah, it's not over the top, is it? It's quite a short space of time to see a marked result.
So, and if you're seeing those results, though, you don't want to just stop. You know, you don't want to stop what you're doing. That should be the impetus to keep going with what.
Absolutely. Okay, so we spent a lot of time talking about materials surrounding the diet, but it's important to acknowledge that a good 150-page slab of your book or so is dedicated to purely practical information about implementing the diet. In fact, there are extremely detailed descriptions of everything from meal plans to testing, with a host of tips and tricks to help you into a new way of relating to food. It's a big deal, isn't it, making such a fundamental change?
It is, because it's, you know, it's not what we're taught. And I'll tell you, you know, if I didn't have a young child with brain cancer, I would have questioned this approach as well, especially a decade ago when we found it. You know, it wouldn't have made sense to me to take out all these so-called healthy fruits and vegetables. And the bottom line is, what we do for prevention is going to look a lot different than what we do for treatment. And that's true in conventional world. You are entering a zone where you're going to be undergoing these toxic therapies, because they are all toxic. And hopefully you're going to come out on the other side and, you know, spend a few months or a year recovering from those therapies. And hopefully you're not going to have a recurrence of your cancer. One thing I want to add, Robin, is that there's been this push from the oncology world. They sort of move from talking about, you know, a cure, because they're not getting there. So now they start quoting these, like, 5-year survival rates, like with breast cancer. They'll tell somebody who's newly diagnosed with breast cancer what their 5-year survival rate is. And honestly, it's pretty good. In most newly diagnosed breast cancer, the 5-year survival looks great. And that's what they want people to look at. They don't, you know, they don't talk about what's going to happen at year 6 or 7 or 10 or 15. Mm-hmm. They're just, oh yeah, you know, 5-year survival. So people think when they hit that milestone that they are cured of cancer and they become less vigilant. And my contention is that with something like breast cancer, you've got a lifetime of vigilance ahead of you because of the recurrence rate at a distant time. And at a much higher grade and much less, you know, many fewer treatment options. And so I don't say that you should be afraid. You know, I don't believe that fear helps, but I believe that vigilance does. So if you're being told your 5-year survival is X, you know, maybe you don't want to look at what it's, you know, what those statistics look like at 7 or 10 or 15, but just stay vigilant and don't believe for a minute that you've been cured of your cancer.
Mm, right. Okay. Well, look, we're getting on with the time, but do you want to just give us a sort of whistle-stop tour of this practical section of the book? What's in there for people?
Okay, sure. Because it comes out of what the most common questions that I get from people, and I want both practitioners and people with cancer to be able to read this book and to figure out what it is they need to do. They get confused by what they read on the internet, because most of it is about weight loss, or they get, you know, confused from the fitness world that says eat more fat, eat more fat, eat more fat. And, you know, people with cancer generally don't need to eat, you know, 6,000 calories or 4,000 calories a day, so they don't need to increase their fat to that same level. So I give some really practical guidelines for where you should be with your carbohydrate intake and a food list, you know, what it should look like. Some reasons why you need to limit your protein intake, because I find people are really great at understanding the carbs part of it, probably because of the Atkins diet. So they know how to limit their carbs, but quite often they're overeating protein. And overeating protein is a problem with cancer, because that excess protein can be converted to glucose. So it keeps your glucose level higher than it would be if you were limiting the protein. Plus, it stimulates the the pathways that lead to cancer progression. So I give some tips on how to figure out where, you know, how to calculate the amount of protein and then, you know, the type of protein. And I also address the fear that's out there about the amino acid glutamine. And then in the fat section, I talk about which fats are inflammatory and, you know, in the balance of fats in your diet, you shouldn't be dependent just on one type of fat in the diet. But you really need to be aware of quality in fat as well. Take olive oil, for an example. It's quite often adulterated. It has a lot more of the unhealthy inflammatory fats in it than you might think. So you have to be careful about how you source something like olive oil. And I just, like I said, I just want to inform people. I want to educate people. And when they have a framework for understanding the diet, then they can build on that framework. So what I see is people, you know, coming from a standard diet, they're just going to buy the foods that they're used to, but in the mix that matches keto. And then over time, they upgrade the quality. A little step here, a little step there. They ask me a question about organic versus, you know, non-organic in this product, or GMO. What about GMO? And those are the kinds of things they can make improvements on, for not just for themselves, but for their whole family. That to be that educating, you're addressing the prevention end of it as well as the treatment end of it.
Well, look, the thing that leaps out at me from your book is absolute thoroughness. You know, it's got all the hallmarks of an author who's been there themselves and who can therefore transmit the level and the kind of details the person needs in order to address the practicalities of adopting a new and unfamiliar lifestyle.
And I hope that also that my passion is clear there, because that's where it comes from. My wish to get this out to people comes from my heart, from having gone through this with my son and seeing what a profound impact it had, not just on him, but of course for our whole family, to see our son doing so well for so long. It was just such a gift. And, I am just very grateful that those events lined up in my life that brought me to the place of doing this with my son and then sharing this with other people.
Well, it's certainly coming through in this interview, Miriam. I guess you're completely delighted to have a ringing endorsement on the cover from the father of the metabolic revival, Dr. Thomas Seyfried. I'll just tell listeners...
He's a great friend of mine, yes.
Great. Well, I'll tell listeners, he describes it as an essential resource for any patient, caregiver or oncologist. So that's pretty amazing. And I'd just like to wish you every success with it. It's to be released in the UK mid-October. So we're looking forward to it being for sale here. And my sincere thanks to you for joining us today to tell us all about it.
Well, and thank you. And thank you for bringing this to just not the audience in the UK, but anybody else who's going to be hearing this.
Sure.
It's important that we get this message out, because the momentum is building and we need to keep it moving forward and not let anything take away from that.
Mm-hmm. Many thanks, Miriam.
Thank you, Robin. And thank you to your audience for listening.
You can find full details of Miriam's book and other resources mentioned in this show on the Yes to Life website. That's yestolife.org.uk, and you'll find the link to the Yes to Life show on the homepage. Tickets are now on sale for the Yes to Life annual conference on November the 25th. We've an exceptional lineup of speakers presenting topics around starting the conversation, exploring ways in which integrating conventional cancer care and lifestyle medicine can improve outcomes. Again, click the link from the Yes to Life homepage, that's yestolife.org.uk. In next week's show, I'll be speaking to James Sanderson. James is Head of Personalisation at NHS England. I'll be talking to him about patient choice and patient-centred care, and in particular about personal health budgets. All very important subjects for anyone interested in integrative medicine. I hope you can listen again. Thanks for joining me today. Goodbye.